The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today's episode is pre-recorded, as I'm away in Atlanta, Georgia, at DragonCon. This annual science fiction and fantasy convention also hosts a skeptical fan track, which attempts to spread the love of critical thinking to people who are likely wearing Star Trek uniforms. So there are tons of things that I'm looking forward to attending, like the Scientific Paranormal Investigation Workshop, the Psychology Behind Being a Skeptic and Mathematical Modeling Pitfalls panels, and the live version of the Amateur Scientist podcast, which is a very, very funny show. If they were to play it on a radio station, it may consist solely of a series of bleeps with non-swear words sprinkled liberally throughout. And I'm looking forward to being on a few panels myself. I'm part of the Myths, Feminism, and Skepticism panel, and the panel on diversity in the free thought movement. I'm also moderating the Raising Skeptical Geeks panel, which features SheThought.com's Heidi Anderson, psychologist Barbara Drescher, junior skeptic editor Daniel Loxton, and mythbuster Adam Savage. And if all that wasn't enough, I'll be doing a Live at DragonCon episode of Skeptically Speaking with Heidi Anderson, Kylie Sturgis of the Token Skeptic podcast, Skepticality's Robin Swoopy McCarthy, and Pamela Gay of Astronomy Cast. And we'll be airing that episode next week. So it's going to be a couple of crazy, wonderful days where I probably won't get much sleep, but it will be worth it. On to today's show. Way back in episode 51, we took on the topic of women who have won or contributed to research that won the Nobel Prize in Science. We started with Marie Curie's groundbreaking and Nobel popularizing win in physics and later in chemistry. We discussed Emily Noether, whom Einstein called the most significant creative mathematical genius thus far produced since the higher education of women began. We touched on Marie Curie's daughter, Irene Joliot Curie, who won in chemistry for her work on artificial radioactivity. And we ended with Gertie Corey, who, before winning her prize, was told that she was ruining her research partner's career because it was un-American for a man to work with his wife. Which left us at around 1947, and so we thought that this topic deserved a part two. This time we'll hear about some of the other women who contributed so much to our understanding of the world, and what they had to go through to do it. But first, let's hear from someone near and dear to us on Speaking Up. I'm here with Ryan Bromsgrove, who is, by day, a humble physics student, and by night, or at least on Friday nights, he runs the soundboard for Skeptically Speaking. Welcome to Speaking Up, Ryan.
Thank you. Hello.
So you had to get out from behind the board because you have a particular concern with how the word quantum has been misappropriated?
Yes, I have. A lot of people like to use the word quantum to sell their product, and it really has nothing to do with quantum physics at all.
And we're speaking specifically about alternative health treatments.
Yes, that's a big one.
So let's start with what quantum is.
Okay, most people are familiar with Newtonian physics. They did it in high school. They are probably familiar with F equals MA. And this works pretty well for your everyday life. If you're throwing a ball, you can figure out exactly what's happening just with Newtonian physics. If you go really, really fast, like speed of light fast, then you need special relativity. If you have a lot of mass, like a really huge star or black hole, then you need to talk about general relativity. If you want to go really, really small, like the scale of atoms and electrons, then you have to use quantum physics.
So what specifically does quantum mechanics deal with then?
It deals with a lot of things. One of the things that it deals with is how things that we classically thought of as particles and waves actually can have characteristics of both. A good experiment to explain this with is the electron diffraction experiment. Now, if you imagine you have something like a basketball, and you have a wall with a hole in it, and then behind that wall you have a different wall that records the position that the basketballs hit it, and you throw your basketballs through one by one, they'll pretty much all hit in the same place. If you then have two holes right next to each other, probably about 50% will go through one and 50% will go through the other, and you then end up with basically two areas of the basketballs hitting the wall. If you do that with electrons and you have one slit, you basically get one area where the electrons hit the screen. But then if you put a second slit right next to that first slit and you fire your electrons at both slits, what you get is what you would expect if you were firing a wave through those two slits, not a particle.
So where does Schrödinger's cat come in here?
Schrödinger's cat is a thought experiment that applies one interpretation of quantum mechanics to something that is macroscopic and conscious. By macroscopic object, I mean something that we can see with our eyes and hold in our hands. For example, a cat. Basically, the experiment goes like this. You put a cat in a box, and inside the box, there's a mechanism that poisons the cat based on the decay of an atom, so essentially chance. One interpretation of quantum mechanics says that before you open the box and look to see if the cat's alive or dead, it exists as both alive and dead.
So this is based on uncertainty, then?
Uncertainty is a large part of quantum mechanics. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is one that some people may have heard of, where it states that you cannot know both the position and the momentum of a particle at any given time. The more precisely you measure one of these properties, the less certain you are of the other.
So what does all of this have to do with alternative health?
Nothing really, but they like to use the word to try to sell their product.
Well, you've done a bit of research on some of the products and the treatments that use quantum in their description, so tell us about one.
I'll talk specifically about Quantum Touch. So I went to the Quantum Touch website. They have an about page that has a video. In the video, it shows a guy walking around a park in Hollywood, and he finds people, and one of the things that he does to demonstrate this Quantum Touch technique is he has them hold their arms out and open and close their hands quickly for a couple minutes. Doing this eventually will make your wrists tired. And when this happens, he holds his hands on the wrists on one of the arms. After about 10 seconds of this, the screen transitions, so we really don't know what happens. And he asks the person how their wrist feels in comparison to the other. And basically they say, oh yeah, my wrist feels fine now. Wow, that's amazing. And what's concerning, of course, is that this is a very subjective kind of pain. He's not going up to somebody with a broken arm and fixing that right away.
So what exactly do they say is the relationship between quantum and their product then?
Well, to quote the website, we believe that what we're doing is affecting matter on that quantum subatomic level, and it works its way up through the atoms, the molecules, the cells, the tissue, and then we see bones move. So normally when we're talking about quantum effects scaling up to macroscopic levels, it basically doesn't happen. If you have, say, one electron out of 10,000 doing something weird, by the time you scale that up and take into account the amount of electrons that are in something the size of your bone, nothing weird is going to happen. If you want to see something weird happen, you'd have to wait longer than the age of the universe.
So you're saying that from a scientific perspective, this doesn't make any sense at all?
Well, I guess what they're trying to say is that they actually do make enough quantum effects on the quantum level, such that when it scales up, it does actually have an effect. And to do this, they talk about this life energy concept. Basically, the person who's doing the healing is somehow able to increase their life energy healing vibration to a very high level. And then by appealing to a process called entrainment, the person being healed's body matches this level. So you may be wondering what entrainment is. It's a physical process wherein two different oscillating systems can come to oscillate with the same period. So if you imagine a couple of pendulums oscillating, one oscillation is from the highest point on its left to the right and then back to the left again. And then the period of that oscillation is just the time it takes for it to happen. So over time, these two oscillating pendulums can, by this process of entrainment, come to oscillate with the same period.
So that process does actually exist. So does that have anything to do with quantum?
Well, if you agree that this thing called life energy that they're talking about exists, maybe. But then we have to talk about what this life energy thing is. When people say life energy, typically they don't mean the same kind of energy that we talk about when it comes to physics. They mean this kind of fluffy, intuitive energy feeling that people kind of have an innate understanding of, even though it's not real. You could try to compare that to real energy. So when we're talking about real energy in physics, if you imagine, say, standing on the ground and then jumping, at the peak of your jump, you have a different amount of gravitational potential energy than you did at your starting position. And then the difference between these two energy levels is the energy that it took for you to get there. Most people are familiar with their food having calories in it. And basically, when you do something physical like a jump, your body burns calories. And a calorie is just a unit of energy. In physics, we usually use joules, but it's still a valid unit. A more precise definition of energy is the ability to do work, and doing work is basically working against the force. So if you're jumping, you're doing work against gravity.
So life energy would be...
I don't really know. See, the thing about life energy is nobody ever defines it, so it's very hard to tell exactly what they are talking about.
So the people who promote these kind of things say that quantum deals with very, very tiny things, and molecules are indeed very, very tiny. So why doesn't this have to do with quantum mechanics?
I think it's all to do with the problem of scaling it up. If we go back to the electron diffraction experiments, the wave-like nature of matter has been shown to work with a similar experiment with, I believe they've been able to do it with certain kinds of molecules, but there is a size limit at which the experiment becomes incredibly impractical. If we take something the size of a human being, yes, we actually do have a wavelength, but it's incredibly small.
So why do you think that quantum finds its way into all these products?
The thing about quantum physics is that it's pretty hard. And basically, the people that are selling these products know this. They know that they can count on only a very tiny minority of people having any idea what quantum mechanics is. Even I basically have barely scratched the surface. They're basically making an appeal to authority that very few people have the knowledge to check.
But quantum is used in some products.
If we're talking about something like an atomic clock, for instance, they work by basing their measurements off the transition between two different energy levels of a cesium atom. So if you imagine an atom, we have the nucleus in the center and we have the electrons orbiting. The thing that we discovered via quantum mechanics is that electrons can only have these very specific orbits, and then each of these orbits corresponds to an energy level. When the electron makes a transition between these energy levels, the difference in energy is emitted as a photon. And the way atomic clocks work is by measuring the amount of photons that we have released from the decay of a cesium atom. Basically, we define the second based on this.
This is all very complicated.
That's kind of the point. It's very complicated, and very few people understand it, and so many people can sell their product by saying that their product is quantum.
Does this drive you physics people crazy?
It really does. Like I said, it's quite hard, and I personally have spent a great deal of time trying to understand even the very simplest things about quantum mechanics. So to see people who have no idea what they're talking about taking the buzzwords and applying it to their product, it makes me lose faith in humanity.
That's harsh. Don't make Ryan lose faith in humanity.
Don't make him cry either, please.
Thanks, Ryan, for being on this side of the board.
Thank you for having me on this side of the board.
And now for a bit of news. I'm here with Nicole Gallucci. Nicole is a graduate student in radio astronomy at the University of Virginia and is also the author of the blog One Astronomer's Noise. Nicole was on the show a few months ago to talk about the Dark Skies Bright Kids project, and she's back with an update. Welcome back to the show, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
So just to remind people, what is Dark Skies Bright Kids?
Dark Skies Bright Kids is a program to bring interactive astronomy activities to 3rd through 5th graders in Albemarle County, Virginia. And we are also working on a book, which we're hoping to give out more widely throughout the state of Virginia and hit all the 3rd grade classrooms and school libraries and public schools in Virginia.
And so you're actually here to talk about sort of a new development with the book.
Right, right. So we have this book. It's called Snapshots of the Universe. It is a bilingual book. It's in both Spanish and English. And has this really cute artwork showing these different astronomy concepts from planets to rockets to astronauts to the moon, and describing it in terms that kids can understand and get into the artwork, and with a section in the back for parents and teachers to learn more about these topics and help their kids out as well. So this book, we are applying for a Pepsi Refresh grant. We're applying for $25,000 so that we can print up all these books to give to every third grade classroom in Virginia and every library. We're trying to get this book out to as many kids as possible, all socioeconomic backgrounds. We have the bilingual aspect. So we're really excited about this. And the way you get this grant is through votes. And so we would really like for everyone to come and help us out by voting for our project. The website has you do a free registration, and you can go back and vote once a day, every day, through the entire month of September.
So this only requires clicking, is what you're saying.
Clicking, yes. So, you know, set your browser homepage to it so that when you open it up in the morning, there it is, reminds you to vote. All it requires is a few minutes of the day to come and click and give us a little boost to help us win this grant.
So what is the state of children's science education funding in the U.S.?
I would love to see an improvement in it, definitely. The schools that we've been targeting particularly are schools that have lower math and science scores on the statewide tests. But we want to get this material out to a broader audience and get teachers to use these materials. And in addition, the free materials, the lesson plans that we've been posting on our website as well.
So again, people, I'm just going to say this one more time. All it takes is clicking. This requires nothing else on your part, and you could help Dark Skies Bright Kids help more kids access science resources. So one more time, Nicole, where did they go?
They can go right to our homepage. We'll have a link up on the main page. It's www.astro.virginia.edu/DSBK. We'll have a link up there. We also have a Facebook group. Just search for Dark Skies Bright Kids on Facebook, and we'll be linking to it every day, I'm sure.
Lovely. Thanks very much for coming on the show, Nicole.
Thanks for having me, Desiree.
And absolutely good luck.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're on the line today with Sharon Birch McGrain. Sharon is a former newspaper writer and physics editor for the Encyclopedia Britannica. She's the author of Nobel Prize Women in Science and also Prometheans in the Lab, Chemistry and the Making of the Modern World. She's currently at work completing Bayes' Rule, a history of Bayesian probability. She lives in Seattle, Washington. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, Sharon.
Well, thank you for having me, Desiree.
Absolutely. So last time we ended with Gertie Corey, and chronologically, the next female winner of the Nobel Prize in Science was Maria Goeppert-Mayer.
Correct. She won a Nobel Prize in Physics for explaining the shell model of the nucleus. She did her work as a volunteer professor. She ran up against what today we'd consider would be a basic civil rights issue for women. That is, there were state laws and university regulations all over the United States that said that a university could not hire a relative of one of its employees. And these rules were interpreted almost exclusively against wives. And they were terribly damaging for women scientists because most of them were married to other scientists. For example, as late as the 1980s, two-thirds of the married women physicists were even married to other scientists, and most of them were even married to other physicists. So the issue of could a woman marry and have children and have a professional career, the answer was no in most U.S. universities, particularly research universities, which were at the time until the 80s all male. Maria Goeppert-Mayer worked at Johns Hopkins and Columbia and the University of Chicago. She had all the responsibilities of a regular professor, but her titles were things like voluntary researcher, voluntary associate professor. She works her way all the way up to be a voluntary professor, and she's not paid a university salary until she and her husband both get job offers from the University of California in San Diego. And 24 hours later, the University of Chicago discovers that, lo and behold, it can pay Maria Goeppert-Mayer a salary. And I'm delighted to say that both Mayers go to California, and it's there that she wins her Nobel Prize.
Now, her first paid position, it looked like it was to be a senior physicist under one of her students, actually.
These are her conditions under universities. She does work during the war and after the war at federal government jobs, and for those she is paid. And while she's at the University of Chicago, her former graduate student has become the head of a division at the Argonne National Laboratory, and so the former student hires his professor and pays her there.
And so that's where she ended up doing her research on the nuclear shell model.
She did it in both places because she'd do the theory and so on in University of Chicago, and then she'd go to Argonne and talk about what experiments could be done to develop the data she needed to fill it in. So she was doing it at both. But Argonne should be very proud of itself, and I think it is. The federal government, for these women who were so trapped, so excluded from university research, there were places that they could find shelter in and do work. Now, for Maria Geppert-Mayer, she was like the sixth or seventh generation university professor in Germany, where she grew up. And her father wanted his only child, Maria, to be a university professor. So for her, there was no escape. She had to make it somehow in a university.
So what kind of impact did her research have on the field?
Well, it explained the shell model, the construction of the nucleus. It was terribly important. It's the basis for nuclear physics. You know, I should say here that it sounds a little bit as though Maria didn't understand the discrimination she faced, but she did. She said, for example, that you just can't move too far ahead of your supporters, of your friends. She felt it like a political situation, like the way a politician senses a popular issue. You can't move too far ahead of your constituents. But she also, at one point, she heard that there was another woman physicist who was thinking of getting married. And she sits this woman down and pours her a very stiff drink of scotch, which was Maria's approach to a good many problems. And she told this woman that life as a woman physicist was very difficult, but life as a married woman physicist was almost impossible. So she recognized this, but she just was so madly in love with physics and with being a university professor, even a voluntary one, that she kept going.
Now, Barbara McClintock is a direct descendant of this kind of impossible to be married.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And she took a very different approach to how she could survive. She only talked to two people for a book. And when she talked to me, she told the same story four different times in increasing degrees of specificity. So I think it's really important. This story meant so much to her to understand it. She was at the top of her profession, but she'd been unable to find a permanent job. She was about to get into the National Academy of Sciences. She was about to become president of the Genetics Society of America. She had honorary doctorate. This was a woman at the top of plant genetics. She went to the University of Missouri because they got a big grant in the field to modernize, and her name, unfortunately, was generic enough so that there was another Barbara McClintock in St. Louis who announced her engagement to marry in the newspaper. And when the chairman of the botany department heard that Barbara McClintock was going to get married, he thought it was his Barbara McClintock. And he calls her into his office. At this point, Barbara McClintock is 34 years old and an assistant professor. And he tells her, if you get married, you will be fired. Can you imagine? No, of course not. So McClintock said years later, she told me that the University of Missouri was awful, awful, awful. She had that pattern. If something was really bad, she'd repeat the word. She said the situation for women was unbelievable. It was so bad. So eventually she walks into the dean's office and asks point blank whether she would ever get on the permanent staff. And the dean sort of grins and says, no, as a matter of fact, when your mentor leaves, you're going to be fired. And she's so mad, she packs everything into her. She has a Model A Ford since 1936. She packs everything into it and drives off. She has not a clue what she's going to do. No job. She decides she never wants a job again. She thinks about maybe she'll be a weather forecaster. And it's several years before she changes her mind. But she eventually goes not to another university. That's the point of all of this. Maria Geppert-Mayer makes a go of it on her university's terms. Barbara McClintock will not bend. So she goes to a research institute, to Cold Spring Harbor, which was much smaller at the time. But the Carnegie Institution funds her there and makes her totally an independent entity within the laboratory.
So that was very important to her at that time, that she wanted to do pure research.
Yes, she did. She was not a teacher.
No, she definitely wasn't a teacher. She had a bit of a temper, that one.
Oh, yes, she did.
Actually, she had an interesting childhood. She was born Eleanor, but...
and she didn't like that. That was too soft and sweet, wasn't it?
That is fascinating. Not much of an Eleanor. Apparently, Barbara's a bit more butch.
Well, her mother was very much against Barbara's getting an education. She thought it would make her unmarriageable. And Barbara has a long-term beau whom she likes very much, and the mother pushes on her. And Barbara decides that although he's a very nice young man, if she got into a marriage, she would so dominate the partnership. And her commitment to herself was to be free, to be independent. And she didn't want to make someone else dependent. So she breaks off the relationship.
So her mother didn't want her to attend college, but her father was actually quite supportive.
Yes, that is true. Her mother, years later, took a summer course at Cornell that was somehow offered to the public and for the first time understood why her daughter would want to learn. Isn't that awful? I think it's awful.
It's a whole different time period. I can't even wrap my head around how that would feel.
Well, at least she figured it out at some point.
She did end up attending Cornell. Is it the case that she had tried to go, her mother had said no because her father was away at war?
Right.
And then
right.
He came back and then she was allowed to attend college.
Yeah, he overruled the mother.
When she went to Cornell, she began studying corn. Why corn?
Genetics was the first scientific field to be much of anything in the United States. So if she was going to go into the most exciting, most quantified science at the time, it would have been genetics. And corn genetics had a big demand. Corn was a big product. Cornell was partly agricultural. And with her studies, she could, you know, we're so used to spreadsheets and so on. But she developed by hand these spreadsheets where she could look at an ear of corn and see the kernels changing color. And so on, and it meant so much to her that I think that's why it was a very exciting field at the time.
And she made quite an impression on everyone, especially on the prominent geneticists of that time.
You know, I interviewed a man and his wife in corn genetics, and they were late 80s at the time. And we had a long and very productive interview. He was wonderful. And then he said, "My wife wants to tell you something." And she got on, and I said, "Could you help me understand Barbara McClintock?" And she had one story to tell me. And she talked about how during a long drought, McClintock goes out to her field where she had planted her plants in an experiment. And she laid water pipes up to this patch of hers, which was on top of the hill. And she would stand there in the hot sun watering the plants. And she would be so tired that there would be tears coursing down her cheeks. And then at night, there was a flood. And she replanted her washed out corn by the light of her car headlights. Even at the time, people knew McClintock. She was just more determined than anyone else. This was a whole group of women who couldn't face life without doing science. That's how they survived.
So what led to her winning the Nobel Prize? What specifically did she win for?
Well, she won for corn genetics in general, but what they called the jumping gene at the time. But she was in her 80s. She told me, you know, I won all my money in my 80s. She was, at one point when we were talking, she was trying to do her bank statements. She made some comment about how she'd won all of this in her 80s, and that was true of this. But Barbara McClintock was, there's a pecking order even in Nobel Prizes, it's what you discover. And Barbara McClintock is at the top of that pecking order. She was the shining example to scientists, of not just a woman who survived such terrible, difficult discrimination, but also of a scientist whose work was rejected for decades. She was funded by the Carnegie Institution. They protected her so that when people were laughing about her work, she wouldn't even try to publish it. She would do the whole study. She'd write it up. She'd put it in a notebook, and she'd file the notebook on her shelf. And the idea to other scientists that someone would keep going, even when there was no publication. Some Nobel Prize winner I was talking to, and he said, I'm going to Stockholm. There's a conference of other Nobel Prize winners. And he said, do you think I'll be able to meet Barbara McClintock? She's the top.
And she continued researching pretty much until her death at 90.
Yes, until 88, 89, she was full-time. She just loved it. She said, it's such a pleasure to carry out an experiment when you think of something, to carry it out and watch it go. It's a great, great pleasure. It couldn't be nicer. I just said, I've had such a good time. I've had a very, very satisfying and interesting life.
We're speaking today with Sharon Birch McCrane, author of Nobel Prize Women in Science, Their Lives, Struggles, and Momentous Discoveries. So let's talk about Shensheng Wu.
Well, you're braver than I am saying her first name. She mostly used C.S. Wu, her initials, because non-Asians, non-Chinese just couldn't swing the. I called one of her colleagues and I tried the first name, and he didn't know who I was talking about.
So I probably mangled it, is what you're saying.
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea, Desiree. But professionally, and the physicists know her as C.S. Wu, so I think we're safe. Well, we need to ask ourselves, how did these women survive? How did they cope? How did they keep going? I asked one of Barbara McClintock's friends, who was Helen Krauss. She was the discoverer of biological imprinting, but got credit only at the very end of her life. She just exploded and said the women who survived in science were the ones with the strength to abide in a world where they weren't wanted. They had to have stamina and brains and nerve and gall to survive. You're not going to find a weeping willow making it. And these women had some things going for them. Strength of character, obviously, we've seen that. Most of the women who won science Nobels until very recently were born or raised during the first women's movement, which is around the time of the First World War when the suffrage campaigns in the U.S. and in Europe were trying to improve the status and education of women. And C.S. Wu, who was born and raised in China, is an example of that, of how powerful this movement was. Wu does not win a Nobel Prize. She's an experimental physicist, and she does the experiment that shows that the fundamental law of parity can sometimes be violated. And there is a long pattern, or was a long pattern, in the Nobel Prize of giving the prize only to theorists, not to the experimentalist who validates the law. And people in C.S. Wu's field just pin me to the wall and tell me how unfair that prize was, how she should have gotten it with them. That is it, May. She was backed by her entire family. Her father was a feminist. He was trained as an engineer, but he takes part in the Chinese Revolution to topple the Manchu dynasty around the time of the First World War, and he is a feminist. He goes back home to his village outside of Shanghai, and he starts the area's first school for girls. And he says he wants a place for everyone who has suffered to be able to go. And he starts the school, and C.S. Wu goes through it, and at the time, eventually it goes through high school, but at the time it stopped at the fourth grade. And the question then becomes, what is this bright little girl to do? Is she going to quit school or what? And the father takes her to the matriarch of the family, the great-great-grandmother, and says, what should be done? Now, the grandmother had never been to school, but somehow she learned to read, and she always had a book in her hand. and she said, this child, this little girl, needs the best possible education, even if it's far away. So she goes to a boarding school, about 50 miles away up the river, and goes there through high school. Her teachers, I think, were Chinese, but they had many connections with American universities. And there would be a lot of visitors coming through and speaking and so on, and it had a very Western curriculum. It was very practical. There were two levels to the school. You could go free if you were going to be a teacher, so it was like a normal school, or you could go in the academic route, which cost more, and her family didn't have that much money at the time. So she was in the teacher's track, and she soon realized that her classmates in the academic track were learning more than she was. So here was this little kid, and she organizes that when her friends go to bed at night, they pass their books to her, and she would keep studying late at night in their books. So she got as much science and math as they did and discovered she really liked it. So her family sends her to Nanjing University, where she organizes an underground student movement against the Chinese invasion, and they have boycotts of Japanese goods. They march and occupy Chiang Kai-shek's palace. He's like the president at the time, so she always described it to me as the White House, that they occupied the White House until he came out and talked to them, and then they disbanded. And then her uncle, who has made money, steps in, and first there had been the father and the mother supporting her education, and then there's been the great-great-grandmother, and then came this uncle who gives her the money to go to the United States and postgraduate study in physics. So it's a massive family effort to get a little girl the best possible education that she could. And isn't that fabulous?
She was obviously very close to her family, and after she did go to the United States to work on her PhD, she had always planned to go back to China.
She does not get to go back for 40 years. First, there's the Second World War. She winds up at Berkeley, which was a leading physics department at the time. And a year later, the Japanese invade China, and she hears no more from her family until after the war. Then there is the civil war between the communists and the Chiang Kai-shek's forces, and then there's the takeover with the communist regime, and then there is the Mao revolution. And so there's 40 years before she can go back to see them, and by the time then her parents have died.
And that's a lot of pressure for someone to be under at that point. If you know you can't go home, you have to succeed because you can't go back.
Correct. The day that the newspapers have the headlines about Japan invading China, the head of the department calls her in and says, we're very sorry about this, but we will take care of you. But that's all she has.
So what did her research focus on at that time?
She becomes an expert in fission, which points up another problem that she had, that although China fought Japan far longer than we did, the anti-Asian atmosphere was so intense in the United States that even though she was Chinese, not Japanese, for example, she didn't get hired for several years, any defense work. And she never went to Los Alamos, which was kind of one of the big things. She was the expert in fission.
Right.
Niels Bohr, Oppenheimer, Fermi all said she was the expert. But Oppenheimer believed that physics was for young, bright young men. He didn't hire too many women.
Now, did she end up working on the Manhattan Project?
She did, but she did at Columbia. She finds a job teaching, believe it or not, at Princeton, which at the time was no women. But they were training Navy officers in math and physics as fast as they could, so she was hired to do that. And she got some other jobs. And then she's hired at Columbia, and after the war, she's kept on. And she marries another Chinese-American physicist. She works at Columbia. They live in New York City, and he works out on Long Island, which is a commuter train ride away. He stays there during the week, and so they had a commuter marriage for most of their marriage. But they made it work. They have a child.
And so she was one of the people responsible for devising the experiment that would show that particles inside a nucleus could violate the laws of parity. Now, what does that mean?
Well, two Chinese-American physicists wondered about this, if it was a natural law. As a matter of fact, Emmy Noether had played a large role in establishing, and natural laws don't get violated. They're always true. And they suggested that nobody had proved it. They came to Wu and said, has anyone proved it? And she said, well, here's the literature. It was this huge compendium of studies, like 1,000 pages. And they went through and concluded, Li and Yang, that it had never been proven. And she thought, you know what? It's not often that a scientist gets to prove or disprove a law of nature. So it was an extremely difficult experiment that she did, but she did it at the National Bureau of Standards, which is now NIST, the National Institute for Science and Technology, outside of Washington. And she would teach during the week at Columbia and do her research and cope with her students there, and then she'd race down to Washington, D.C., and work there.
So now the other two ended up winning the Nobel Prize.
They did. This is this pattern we talked about earlier, that the experimentalist in those days did not necessarily win the prize. No one had believed, not even Li and Yang thought, that the natural law would be violated. And it was Wu who showed that it sometimes was. But she didn't get the prize. And there again, people are really upset in her field, feel that that was a fundamental mistake. The Nobel Prize is very carefully done. But this is one that people in the field really think should have included Wu.
Right. Well, she did, on the other hand,
she got all the other prizes.
Exactly.
Possible.
So that's something.
Yeah. We were talking the last time about what women scientists need to survive. And when I asked that question of Wu, she said, oh, they need a nice husband, a home near work, and good child care. Very practical
Absolutely.
Woman.
Absolutely. I was going to say, that's succinct. Very nice.
Yep. Cuts back to the chase, doesn't it?
Well, actually, Wu seems a bit different than the other women that you wrote about in your book. She's described as elegant and beautiful, and she's also very traditionally Chinese in many ways. Do you think that had any impact at all on her career, besides the obvious racism at that point?
She arrives in Berkeley, and she's very beautiful. She gets her traditional Chinese dress made in Taiwan or in China and shipped to her, and wears them for many, many years. I talked to one man who knew her at Berkeley and who became a very important scientist himself, and I thought the way he was talking with her, he must have just been gaga over her. And the minute his wife came back, he said goodbye and hung up.
Oh my. All right.
But I was struck by the fact Marie Curie was very beautiful. If you look at her pictures, mm-hmm. which are mostly taken later in life when she's ill, she's still beautiful. And it was a very fashionable form of looks at that very considered exotic and beautiful Slavic beauty from Poland.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these women were very good looking. And I thought to myself, that at a time when a male scientist really gained no points, got only demerits by having a woman in his lab, maybe it helped that they were nice to look at?
Maybe. There was actually a quote that I very much liked from her.
Which is that?
I was a woman when it paid to be, and I wasn't one when it paid not to be.
She developed what a lot of physicists or scientists know. The only thing they know about her is that she was called the Dragon Lady.
Right.
And that was from a comic strip about Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who was quite a political character, powerful woman. She had many connections to, for example, Nixon and other conservative Republicans. So they called her the Dragon Lady. And what they were talking about was the people who work with her did not call her that. Men or women. And some of them said, you know, Columbia Physics Department was so filled with driven, arrogant men that she was not in their ballpark. She was much less than that. She was more maternal. But she was terribly worried that her students would not make it. And she knew the obstacles they would have. They were studying with a woman. They were women themselves. They were Asian American. They were this. They were that. She had to make them so perfect that they could survive. So she would tell them when they were wrong. And she insisted, she got very upset if the lab wasn't going all night long. You know, she was a slave driver. But apparently no worse and probably better than others at the time.
Well, that's just an additional pressure. When you're already under pressure as a female scientist, to add the fact that you desperately want your students to succeed.
Yes. When one of her students had a child who published an article and she saw the article, she said, you know, I felt like a proud grandmother. So she saw her role as very maternal.
And we'll be right back with more on women and their Nobel Prize winning science research right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we feature a panel of female skeptics recorded live from SkepTrack at DragonCon. Kylie Sergis, Robin Swoopy McCarthy, Heidi Anderson, and Jenna Marie Griffith discuss the contributions of women to science and the skeptical community. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're speaking today with Sharon Birch McCrane, author of Nobel Prize Women in Science, Their Lives, Struggles, and Momentous Discoveries. So this is completely out of chronological order at this point, and I notice that I'm quite fascinated with women who didn't end up winning the prize.
Yes.
Specifically, Rosalind Elsie Franklin.
Yes. Well, she didn't win the prize because she was dead.
Well, there's
it's
that.
It's as simple as that. She did the X-ray crystallographic pictures of DNA that Watson and Crick used without permission to figure out the structure of DNA. She later goes on and becomes the world's leader in the molecular structure of viruses, and she really lays the foundation for structural molecular biology. She dies of cancer at 37, and a few years after that, Watson and Crick come up for a Nobel Prize. Now, it's not given posthumously. If you're dead, you don't get it. So the reason why Rosalind Franklin didn't get it is because she was not alive. So the question is, had she been alive, would she have won the prize? And I think we have to say yes, because the head of the laboratory where she did her work and published it, so there was a published record of her contribution, insisted that someone from his lab be in on that prize. Now, had she been alive, who would they have picked? The one with the published record? I think they would have. So if Rosalind Franklin had been alive, I feel sure she would have won the prize with Watson and Crick.
But Wilkins won it instead, and that was her research partner.
Correct. But he was in the laboratory where they both worked.
So what kind of research was she working on that became so important to Watson and Crick?
They were trying to figure out the shape, the structure of this molecule, and she had taken photographs of it. She could tell them what it looked like.
She was carefully guarding that at that point. Watson and Crick hadn't seen it until Wilkins showed it to them.
That is correct. So there's that controversy involving her. There's also the fact that afterwards, Watson writes The Double Helix, this absolutely delightful bestseller, which is still used in classrooms, and it really helps if you have a villain to write a story. And she becomes his villain. He portrays her as this cold and sexless, humorless, mediocre scientist. And one, she obviously was not a mediocre scientist. That's clear from her career from the beginning to the end. Everything she goes into, she becomes the authority on. And he used it. But he even changes her personality. She was apparently just fun-loving. She said at one point, what's the point of doing this if you don't have fun? She was a mountain climber. She long-distance bicyclist. She'd worked in France and learned all about French wine, and at the time, English cooking was world famous for being appallingly bad, but she'd learned French cooking, She was fashionable. He talks about her as being dowdy. She raised her hemlines up and down with every season the way women used to do. He creates a totally different picture. I talked to several of her colleagues at the time, one of whom won his own Nobel Prize later, and I didn't know how to describe her just in a few words. So at a conference, they actually had a little caucus for me, a meeting, and explained the situation that Sharon McGrain needed to know for her book, Nobel Prize Women in Science, just the essence of Rosalind Franklin. And they came up with the expression, commanding leader. Now, that's not the way Watson portrays her. It has nothing to do with her picture. But it's hard to fight a bestseller that's been assigned to students for decades.
Well, the only positive part of him writing this book, as far as I can see, is the fact that he was so open about the fact that they used her data.
Oh, yes. He provides the entire case against himself in his book. He's quite open. When I interviewed him, I went in and I told his friends that I thought he would backtrack. He would say, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. But he wasn't. He said, I wrote it the way it was. He didn't backtrack at all.
Is it just me, or is that supremely arrogant? Because honestly, he's so blatant about stealing her work, and he feels no guilt at all about this. And like I say, maybe that's for the best, because people really didn't start to examine her role until that book came out.
Yeah, it was Ann Sayers' book. Ann Sayers' husband worked in crystallography, and Rosalind Franklin used some of those techniques in her work. So they knew Rosalind quite well. And Rosalind's friends and colleagues got Ann Sayer to write the book that was the case against Watson.
How often do you think that this happened to women of that generation, that their work was just appropriated?
Well, for example, we talked about Maria Geppert-Mayer, the archetypal volunteer professor. She and her husband, who was a prominent chemist, wrote a book together, and it was about quantum physics applied to chemistry. Now, her husband didn't know zip about quantum physics. That was her field. But when she went to Columbia, they wouldn't even give her a little fake title to put under her name as the co-author. They thought she was the secretary, and I think that was the case. And there were a lot of these couples all over the United States, especially in biology, and I think that was probably the case with most of them.
I'm trying to figure out, actually, how to end this interview now. We always end on such a sad note.
Yes, right. Well, we shouldn't. So let's ask again the fundamental question. How did these women survive? How did they cope? And one of the things they really had was they had a religious background, mostly, that stressed education. One of the women in the book, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, is a Quaker. Half of the women came from Jewish families, although their fathers didn't necessarily help them. And all but one of the 15 women in the book had personal support from somebody who believed in them. It was often their husband. It was often a prominent scientist. We saw how Emmy Noether had Einstein and David Hilbert in their corner. So I think we must not underestimate the power of an individual to help someone in difficulty, because all of these women had support at some point in their lives at crucial times that helped them and kept them going. But mostly, of course, they kept going because they were just nuts about science. They were having so much fun.
Sharon, I love the way that you can leave these episodes on such a positive note.
Well, that comes from my newspaper training, which said that these things have happened. I am not responsible for them, but it is good if they can be brought to light. That mere act of your bringing these things to light, I think people don't know about. I talked to a former dean at the University of Washington who operated under these laws, and his mouth fell open. The Quakers, come on, they've got their hearts in the right place.
Absolutely.
So all we can do is, you know, we can't make people do things, but we can give them facts so they can make up their own minds. That we can do.
And we can continue having these conversations, because this time we reach 1983. So we're doing well. Maybe at this rate, we'll catch up to the present day next year sometime. Thank you so much, Sharon.
Sharon's website is McGrane.com, where you can find her book, Nobel Prize Women in Science, as well as all her other books. And you may not have long to wait to find out what women are up to now. Next week, I'll be airing the Live at DragonCon show, where I'll be talking with Kylie Sturgis, Pamela Gay, Heidi Anderson, and Robin Swoopy McCarthy about today's scientific and skeptical heroines. Now, usually when evidence-oriented women are gathered together on a panel, the conversation almost invariably gets around to a topic that can broadly be called, why aren't there more of us? And the main components of that discussion tend loosely to be something like how women are treated as skeptics and scientists, the unique pressures that women feel in these sometimes phallocentric spheres, and what can and should be done to level the playing field. But I feel like too often the thing that gets overlooked is what women are actually accomplishing despite all that. And it seems like there's room every once in a while to start from a place of not ignoring the disparities, but letting them take a back seat. So the next episode of Skeptically Speaking will be exploring the contributions of women to the skeptical and science communities. And in the meantime, check our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
I'm Barbara Drescher of ICBSEverywhere.com, where I write about the benefits of reason and the dangers of superstition. Today I'd like to talk about why women in particular should embrace science and scientific thought. Science is our method for examining our world and discovering what's true. And with that knowledge, we're better able to feed our families, teach our children, and live longer and more enjoyable lives. But we're missing something. Although boys and girls achieve equally in math and science through high school, the proportion of men who enter college planning to major in science and engineering is double the proportion of women. Women earn fewer doctoral degrees and are grossly underrepresented among faculty in these fields. These gaps are shrinking, and they're a shadow of what they were decades ago, but they remain alarming. You might be thinking, so what? Why does it matter if women are not interested in science, as long as they're given the same opportunities? But this is a loaded question. For many reasons, when the numbers are this lopsided, women just do not have the same opportunities. And even if they did, there are many reasons to correct it. I could talk about how, without collaboration and diversity of viewpoints, innovation is slow and focused on the needs of the investigator or the designer. But what should we tell a 10-year-old girl who asks, why science? Why science for me? And I would answer, why not? The disparities we have now exist because at some point in human history, people decided that women were not as capable of achieving in these fields. Even today, the myth that women are less intelligent than men persists. Some still believe that women are innately less capable in math and spatial skills, and girls begin to internalize this belief as early as middle school. Yet research has shown that intellectual skills are acquired, and given the same education and encouragement, the same levels of achievement are possible. Critical thinking takes effort, but we're all capable of learning to use it. So girls, ladies, women, chicks, gals, whatever you want to call that X chromosome that separates half of us from the other half, you should embrace science for yourself, because it will help you lead a better life. But most of all, you should embrace science because you can.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online. Reading tarot cards and witches, psychics. And their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams. The charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus. Eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.